You know that sound your phone makes when there's an Amber Alert? It's a jarring sound, and it's hard to know what to do when you hear it, other than feel kind of annoyed, which is awful. Because the sound means someone somewhere is having a really bad day, the worst probably. But I mean, you get the make and model of a car to look out for, maybe the age and gender of a missing child, and that's supposed to help? I don't know about you, but I'm not entirely sure how this whole system is intended to work. KCUR's Andrea Tedhope went to find out.
These days, we get notifications on our cell phones all the time. Texts, emails, Facebook messages, Instagram, Twitter, I could go on. So we've developed a tendency to ignore. That goes for emergency alerts, too.
We don't want these alerts to become white noise in the background.
I spoke over the phone with Mike Turner. He's Missouri's Amber Alert Coordinator, based out of the Highway Patrol headquarters in Jefferson City. Back in the 90s, a 9-year-old girl named Amber went missing in Arlington, Texas. Despite a witness to the abduction and a widespread effort to save her, she was found dead after 4 days. But her case set conversations into motion among neighbors and local police. That's how the Amber Alert came to be. Now, I have to say, it's pretty hard to imagine that this sound could become white noise.
Well, it's a loud, audible tone, and it's designed to get your attention. It's not just another text message. It's not just another email. It's a message of critical importance.
You hear this alert for tornado warnings and dangerous floods, severe weather that could be dangerous to you, but they're also important because data shows that 74% of kidnapped children who are found dead were murdered within 3 hours of being taken. So it's also of critical importance that the alert go out as quickly as possible. Mike is the guy behind the curtain making that happen. His team consists of 20 telecom professionals and radio operators. His staff has other duties for the Highway Patrol, but when local law enforcement agencies call with a missing child report,
it is all hands on deck.
He compares the process to a pit stop during a NASCAR race.
You know, when you see that car pulling into the pit stop, everybody has a job, and each one of them is trained to do it very fast and efficient, or else they don't get out of the pit quick.
Every second is critical.
We conduct drills in our radio room where we give them a mock scenario of an abduction, and I want to see the steps that they're taking to activate that Amber Alert, and I'm watching for any wasted movements or any wasted time. There's a misconception that there's a single button that we push to activate an Amber Alert when it's actually several moving parts and various technologies working together.
When a report comes in, first his team has to determine if there's proof of kidnapping or at least of the threat of immediate harm. Then they have to make sure it contains enough information to be useful to the community.
And I think one of the reasons people ignore alerts is that they lack the basic details or that they're false alarms.
So they work to get the right information, submit it to a mobile communications platform, and then the crucial details are disseminated through the WEA. That's the Wireless Emergency Alerts Network that brings us alerts from the president and warnings of imminent threats like the Boston Marathon bombing. Turns out that before the WEA came into the fold, cell phone and email users actually had to opt in to receive Amber Alerts. But since 2013, the WEA sends the alerts to your phone, email, radio, television, and in Missouri, there's a committee backing the Amber program, consisting of the Departments of Transportation and Public Safety, even the Missouri Lottery, which gets the message out onto highway signs and lotto machines and gas stations. Mike calls it reliable redundancy.
We want to get accurate information out through as many avenues as possible to as many people as possible as soon as we can.
The most recent national data shows that in 2015, 58 of 224 missing children involved in Amber Alerts were successfully recovered directly because of the Amber Alerts. That's 26%, which is about the average rate over the past 11 years. Many more children were found alive, but not because of the Amber Alert. Best case scenario?
It empowers the community to work together with law enforcement and the media to increase the safety of our communities.
A lot happens between the moment a child goes missing and the moment the alert reaches your phone or your radio or the electronic highway signs. But the critical work of finding that car, that suspect, that missing child, still lies in the hands of the community.
That was KCUR's Andrea Tedhope. And as for the notion that it's up to the community, not just technology, to find a missing child, that's what we're interested in talking about today. I'm Gina Kaufman, and this morning's show is about how communities solve problems in 2017. Do we have a tendency to think technology is taking care of things, that we don't need to bother getting involved? Is it still up to us to know our neighbors and look out for each other? First, let's talk to Damon Daniel. He's with us from the Ad Hoc Group Against Crime, and he's been a community organizer for a long time. Hi, Damon.
Good morning.
So this is a big question, but if you had to say where the power to solve a problem comes from, like as a community, using your experience, if you had to boil it down to one thing that makes the difference, what would it be?
Relationships.
Explain.
Well, you know, as a former community organizer, and I have to say I'm not a former. Once you're a community organizer, you're always a community organizer. You just do it at different levels. But I've always seen, even through my work as a community organizer, that the power rests in relationships. And so it's really about, when you talk about community solutions and things of that nature, it's about listening to others, finding out if there's others who are concerned about the same issues as you, people who have the same vision for their community as you, and then working together. It's all about developing relationships, tapping into some of those current relationships as well, whether that's with your neighbors or local elected officials, et cetera.
That might sound, I mean, coming out of this story all about how people respond to a situation where there's a missing child, I mean, that is an urgent situation, and we're hearing about, you know, drills running behind the scenes, needing to intervene within 3 hours because that's the time frame where most missing children who end up dead are killed. You know, like 3 hours.
Mm-hmm.
It's fast pace. Something like relationships when life and death are at stake, that mm-hmm. might sound fuzzy to people.
Well, you know, just last week, I got a call from a mother whose child left a note behind, and that note indicated some self-harm. And she came to us. She went to the police department, filed a police complaint. I mean, not a complaint, but a police report. And the first thing we did was got on the air and made an announcement. And then we posted information on Facebook with a description of the young lady and her picture and all of that. Within hours, we got calls from either some of her classmates that knew her and heard about the announcement on the radio. And it pretty much spread on social media as well through Facebook and Twitter and things like that. And she was found later that evening. She called her mom and said, "I'm okay," and came home. So part of that was folks who recognized her name, which was her classmates. And then part of it was just folks who stay connected to us as an organization that also responded and just said that they were concerned and they would keep an eye out for her. And so I think, you know, yes, technology definitely helped in that regard, whether it was the Facebook post or whether it was folks who listened on the air.
So it sounds like technology and then maybe the media, having mm-hmm. relationships with the media, but then also an existing community. Like
that's
her
correct.
Classmates knew her name already.
Right.
What about other kinds of communities? That's maybe a school community you could tap into in that situation. Mm-hmm. What are some other kinds of communities? Can you give me a recent example you've witnessed in a Kansas City community where some regular people took it upon themselves to address a situation they were fed up with?
Well, you know, just last year, we celebrated the installation of a camera in a local park. For many years, Seven Oaks neighborhood had wanted a camera in a local park to deter some of the substance abuse issues and some of the criminal element that was taking place in this park. And it wasn't until a young kid by the name of Hassan Williams was shot and killed in broad daylight a few months before he was to graduate high school that folks decided to take matters in their own hands. And so one of the things that we were able to do is we met with the Neighborhood Association.
Wait, can I back you up
sure.
a second? Because you've gone from people decided to take things into their own hands mm-hmm. to what you were doing. Do you know how the beginning of their first steps looked mm-hmm. before you even came into the picture?
Well, you know, they had contacted their local elected officials about that. They had talked to police about increasing police presence there. But those things often were temporary in terms of some of those responses. But it wasn't until we identified a local funding source to have those cameras put in place, and it wasn't until we had some frank conversations with local city council about those funds and how we can make it happen. And one of the things that that city councilman, Jermaine Reed, at the time said to us was, he's willing to support that if we can get some more consensus from the neighborhood around using those specific dollars for that. And so we went door to door with the family of Asan Williams' mother and father and grandmother and other family members and neighborhood folks. Went door to door with a petition and gathered over 70 signatures for folks that lived in that immediate area. And we got the cameras.
So door to door, that's pretty old school.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. But it still works. You know, it's all about, again, those relationships. It's all about listening. It's all about trying to see if folks have a similar vision, as well as the concern to address those, or the, you know, vision to address those concerns. And we found that a lot through the neighborhood.
I'm interested that various neighborhoods, various groups can come to you for support and intervention in the problems that they're trying to solve for themselves, and often need that outside assistance, need that extra push. What is the difference between the kind of problems that people can just kind of solve on their own and the kinds of problems where someone in an official kind of capacity like you needs to step in?
Well, you know, I think it's a little bit of both. Oftentimes, you know, folks have an ideal of what they want to do, but often they don't know how to go about accomplishing it. And so having an organization that has that experience under their belt to leverage those kinds of resources to aid them is important. So it's a kind of a both and.
Yeah. What is it that the community has to do? I mean, what has to be in place in order for you to help that you can't just come in and do?
The will. The will to want to make something happen. I tell folks all the time, there was a, let me give you a couple of examples. I got a call from a gentleman who was kind of fed up of some of the drug activity in his neighborhood. And he was calling us to get more police presence. And I said, well, you know, sir, you can call the police and see if they will, you know, have an extra car come, that sort of thing. I said, I'm happy to pass on the message as well. But what you have to understand is it's all about going up to those individuals, going door to door to your neighbors and having these frank conversations with them about, hey, if you're tired of feeling like a prisoner in your own home, then let's band together and address this issue head on. And he was unwilling.
Do you think people are scared to do that?
Not only were, well, in this case, this gentleman, yeah, he was a little, I could tell that there was a little bit of fear there, but also he just didn't have the will to want to go door to door and talk to his neighbors.
Did he know them already?
Huh?
Did he know them already?
You know, some he did and some he did not. And I told him, I said, that's part of the problem is if you don't know your neighbors, and they don't know where you stand on specific issues like drug activity in your neighborhood, then it's going to continue to exist. And so until you go door to door and you talk to your neighbors and you be in relationship with them and you let those who are sort of the problem houses, if you all band together, I say, I can't come into your neighborhood and go and talk to that problem house without your support and the support of your neighbors. Otherwise, you know, it's not going to work. And so, one, he lacked the will to want to do that. And so I said, well, sir, just having police just drive by the neighborhood isn't going to help.
But you know what? Okay. I mean, I have had issues with neighbors, and they were minor compared to what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. But in my experience, it's really intimidating to possibly broach a subject that is going to make the person who is right there every time you come home to your house mm-hmm. and every time you leave your house, to make that person really, really mad at you.
Mm-hmm.
That's scary.
Absolutely. It can be very intimidating. And I tell folks, you know, I ad hoc back in the day had an auxiliary group called Black Men Together, where you would have 20 or so African-American males that would show up on the doorstep of a drug house with perhaps some surveillance photos or perhaps a casket from a local funeral home, and they're knocking on the door and they got a bullhorn. They're saying, hey, you have until the end of the week to shut this down. I've often told those original members of that group that if I were to do that today, I'd probably get shot. And so part of, though, our solution to addressing those same issues, in some ways, it's about creating an avenue for folks to report those activities anonymously. And so, you know, and there are several ways that people can do that, either through calling our hotline number or the TIPS hotline number or even Combat, for that matter. And so there's different avenues. And so we provide that information for folks to be able to do that in a anonymous way. But yet those individuals still have to know that they're is a force here that's tired of it. And that's where we come in at. That's where we have volunteers and we recruit volunteers as well as our staff that goes door to door with those same neighbors to say, hey, enough is enough. We care about this neighborhood and we want to see some change. You either be part of it or you're part of the problem.
People wanting anonymity brings me to the question of technology, because the way that technology shapes communities now, a lot of times they're communities of people who aren't living next door to one another necessarily. Meanwhile, the person next door becomes a stranger. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. How have changes in technology changed how you have to do the work you do?
Well, you know, I think it helps in a lot of ways. You know, you take apps like Nextdoor. Right. Where, you know, folks can go online and report crime. They can report suspicious activity and things like that. I've sort of seen where that's been helpful. I've also seen where it's increased. It's not necessarily increased, but it has sort of opened the curtain to reveal some of the racial stereotypes that exist in many of our communities as well. And so when it comes to technology, I think technology by itself can't sustain, and it's not a solution by itself, but it can indeed aid a lot of different efforts. But again, I keep going back to the one word that I lifted up at the beginning is relationships. And having an online relationship, you know, I don't do Facebook. I'm not on Facebook.
Not at all.
Not at all.
Good for you, man.
The closest I get is LinkedIn. But even my point about that is I don't know how many people actually have 300 or 3,000 or a million friends. And so I take the word friend very seriously. If I call you my friend, then you're truly my friend. That means we break bread, we hang out. We have more than just a online relationship. And so just relying on an online relationship is not enough.
Well, so you've used the word relationships and I've been using the word community, like how do communities solve problems? Mm-hmm. And I'm interested in knowing how you define that word as a community organizer.
Well, the word relationship?
Community.
Community. Okay. Well, you know, I think community can be defined by many different ways. I think that if you are within a faith community, or if you're a part of a educational institution, that is your community. It is the folks that you are frequently socialized with, folks in which you have some common or share a common value with. It's folks that you have more than just, I think it's more than just geographic. I think it's also includes economic. It also includes race. It also includes gender as well. And so I look at community a little bit more broadly.
Does the size of a community or just like the nature of how people interact within a community, does that come into play when it's time to solve a problem? I mean, a community exists before the problem arises, but in the examples that you've given where someone wants to stop the drug use in their neighborhood, for example, but they don't know their neighbors, it's like the community has not gelled yet in order to solve that problem. You know what?
I do. But and I think that part of what we witness in those cases is the fracture that exists within the relationships. I mean, It's difficult. If folks don't see themselves as part of a community, then they're not going to respond to the need. You know, I see that a lot where, you know, there's a homicide that occurs east of Truce, and someone who may live west of Truce says, oh, wow, they're really struggling over there, as to say that that's their problem or that's a big problem, but they're not seeing themselves as part of that community. And that's a huge problem that exists in our community. And it's part of it has a lot to do with how segregated Kansas City is, and how it is rooted in some of the racial institutionalized policies back in the day. And we're just sort of suffering the consequences because of those policies. But then also that has contributed to some of the economic segregation that exists in Kansas City as well. And as long as we continue to have this economic segregation in these pockets of poverty, and folks not seeing themselves as part of that community, then we'll continue to see some of these issues as well.
You know, we were just talking about the size of a community. That also brings up the size of the problem. I mean, with the Ad Hoc Group Against Crime, you're trying to solve big problems. You're trying to turn the tide of violent crime in Kansas City, and that includes tackling poverty, systematic racism, disparities in education and healthcare. Mm-hmm. How do you even begin to break down a problem of that magnitude into like a to-do list?
Yeah. Well, we don't do it alone. It's all about partnerships. It's all about collaborating and supporting other efforts as well in every chance we get. And so, you know, as you mentioned, you know, these are big problems, but just like a loaf of bread, you don't sit down and eat one loaf of bread all at the same time.
Sometimes you
slice it up.
You
slice it up. So we're going at it one slice at a time through a pathway of providing healing and a pathway of providing justice.
KCUR's Central Standard has to take a break, but call us at 816-235-2888 to tell us about the problem in your community that needed solving. Were authorities and resources helpful and available when you needed them, or did you have to find a way to solve the problem yourself? 816-235-2888. Up next, when a stay-at-home mom noticed something amiss on the playground, she became an accidental activist. Coming right up. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we're talking about how regular people get their friends and neighbors together to solve problems, whether it's a city block tackling fallen trees after a storm, or a rural community keeping a farm up and running when the farmers got health problems, or something bigger than that, a string of crimes in a certain neighborhood, people needing basic life necessities and not finding resources to access them. Call 816-235-2888 to tell us about the problem your community tried to solve. Did you succeed? Why or why not? 816-235-2888. Now we're joined by Roxana Chaffé. She's a known figure in the Hyde Park neighborhood now, but today she's going to tell a story from when she was brand new to the area. Roxana, good morning.
Good morning, Gina.
So tell me what your life was like when you arrived in Hyde Park.
Well, we were young and we were...
Who's we?
My husband and I. And we were looking for an affordable place to live. We loved the area and we really believed that we would buy our house, we would fix it up, and when it was time to start a family that we would move. And much like Damon was saying earlier, we found a community in Hyde Park and have been there since 2002.
Why did you think you would move?
Because that was the conventional wisdom of the time, right? That we would improve on our investment and we would move to the suburbs where wise people raise children.
So something else happened in You were a stay-at-home mom, is that right?
Yeah, we had our first child in 2003, and I had the great privilege of being able to stay at home. And at the same time, another neighbor in Hyde Park had started a playgroup. The Hyde Park playgroup is still going on today. And as we would organize our weekly visits, I would find myself driving past the park right there on Gillum Road and just became increasingly frustrated that this place was right within walking distance of our home. At the same time,
but you were getting together somewhere else?
Luce Park, Roanoke, right? Other areas. The park was kind of a den of ill repute. There were broken bottles, needles, right? Lots of unsavory activity happening. It was unsafe. The playground equipment still existed, but was rusty and dangerous for children. So just not a place that you would gather as a family or as a community. At the time, my husband was on the Hyde Park board, and I every meeting would ask him, what have you heard about the park? What have you heard about the park? And finally, after a few months, he just came home and said, why don't you call about the park yourself? And I thought, well, okay, that's what I'll do. And the next day I called.
Called who?
I believe at the time it was the Parks Department. I just called the main number and said, I live in the neighborhood and I want to talk to someone about this park. And I was invited in to a meeting. And then from there, a group of neighbors organized around the issue. And
so how did you hook up with those neighbors to address it? I mean, did they just independently also have these concerns, or had you been sort of drumming up support?
Yeah, we had all been talking about it in our various playgroups. I mean, you know, we were all, our block was very tight, so many of us would be outside in the afternoons while the kids played. We all joined together for playgroups, and it had been a conversation that we were all having, right? So everyone was aware of it and the importance of changing this space.
I'm interested in that, you know, you went from coming to this place to create an investment, improve on it, and leave. And in a short time, you have, you know, your husband's on the neighborhood association board, and you are part of a lot of informal networks like play groups and, you know, standing out on your block with other parents and other children in the afternoons. How did that transformation occur?
Well, it's like Damon said, it's relationships, right? The very first day that we were moving into our house, our neighbor marched right out our door and across the street and introduced herself to us, right? And then from that, we now have kind of an informal policy that anytime anyone moves onto the block or within a few block radius, right, we make sure that we make ourselves known and introduce ourselves to them and make them feel welcome in some way. And from that, we organized, like our block alone has multiple events per year. We do block parties and chili parties and that sort of thing.
So you were talking to your friends and neighbors about this, and they all know that you've had a meeting with the city. And then what happens from there? Because you're all concerned about the state of the park.
Right. So the city definitely advised us to build consensus, as Damon discussed. So one of the first things that we had to do, first of all, was demonstrate interest in the park. And we started that by doing monthly cleanups. And so we would advertise that through the play groups and via email at the time. And this is a pretty old project. Social media was not as widely used. So we did a lot by email and phone calls. So we would send out an email
Did you, like, go door-to-door to collect email addresses?
No, the email addresses we collected primarily through, like, our existing social networks, our face-to-face networks, and then people would forward on that way. And then people would see us. We would put up signs as we were in the park, and people would see us there. At one point, we did go door-to-door. Door-to-door is a really effective way of garnering support.
I'm so surprised to hear that, because I have a terrible confession, which is that when someone knocks on my door, I treat that somewhat suspiciously.
Right. A lot of people do. Because we're sort of programmed to that, right? And that's sort of the suspicion of our community, our society. But when you show up at the door with a cute little 3-year-old in tow and a pretty flyer and you want to talk about something that's really important, what we found was everybody wanted to talk about that space because it affected everybody, and not just in the immediate Hyde Park neighborhood, but we met with residents of Mannheim. We met with residents of Squire Park. We met with South Moreland. We met with many, many communities, and it impacted all of those communities. So, yeah, it was a really time-consuming but effective way of garnering support.
What do you think? I mean, it doesn't sound like you came from a place of having a lot of experience doing this kind of thing. It sounds like you were just no one else was solving the problem, and so you were willing to make that first phone call. But as you've gone, what do you think were the main assets that you had that you maybe didn't even recognize?
So at the time, you know, I had righteous passion and a deep well of ignorance, and I didn't really know what I was doing. And so every step of the way, I was willing to try whatever it took, right? And what I found was that the city and the Parks Department were very responsive to us as a group. There was a group of us, first of all, and that they really wanted to solve this problem, too. What I've learned in that is that systems need outside support from the community in order to be as effective as they can. It's very easy for us to sit and say that the Parks Department isn't doing their job or the city isn't doing their job, but really they need our support to do that work. And they were very welcoming and sort of mentored me through that, mentored all of us through that project, through that process. As far as learning, I would say I had no idea what I was doing, and maybe that was really helpful. I think the asset that I bring in hindsight is being a champion for something I believe in, and I've taken that on to do other things in the community.
So how did this particular effort turn out?
So we have a beautiful park, right? It's a really beautiful space. It's a very welcoming space. And it's been about 10 years, I think, since the playground was finished. What we've seen is that it's a huge gathering space. You see families there all the time. There are parties there.
But what happened to the quote-unquote unsavory activity that preceded that?
So there's, right, it's Midtown. So there's a little bit of that that still happens late at night. But for the most part, what I learned through the process is that it just sort of dissipated. I mean, I'm sure it relocated to another place, but it's just not as pervasive in that space as it used to be.
So you were mentioning that you are this champion character. I'm curious about what other characters are maybe required in a problem-solving community effort. Like, I was once doing a story on a bowling alley, and the guy who ran the bowling alley referred to one of his prized employees as the bailing wire, which to him meant that guy did all the invisible little things that made everything come together, and he did it without glory or recognition. Do you need that character too?
Yeah, you need that character. You need there's always the diplomat, the intellectual, right? The person who's willing to do a ton of research, someone who can organize the details, someone who can be a calm voice, because it can be many things end up being controversial when you don't expect it.
What are some of the problems that maybe you haven't been able to solve as this neighborhood champion?
So there's been a couple of issues. Definitely tried to champion some change in my children's school that was frustrating and didn't work out the way we thought. Lydia and I both worked on the circle processes in the neighborhood, and it didn't take off the way we thought that it would, although it's a very incredible process.
What do you think is the difference between those projects that have been successful, like the park, the playground, and projects that, you know, you've tried to get involved in and haven't been able to make quite the difference you'd hope?
It varies from project to project, right? Oftentimes, projects that are successful, the timing, the will of the general public, right? Being able to garner mass support.
I'm going to talk to someone else now, someone from the Hyde Park Neighborhood Association who is on the Communications Committee. Lydia DeMonte, good morning.
Good morning.
So why does your organization have an entire sub-organization for communication?
Well, this is very new, and it's because communication is changing, especially with the great influx of new families and people coming to Hyde Park. A lot of younger people use social media a lot more. And it's kind of what Damon was saying earlier. There can be a bit of a disconnect. People feel like they're doing a lot on social media, but then they don't come to meetings or they don't show up to circle group or what have you. And I am very guilty of this myself. I'm a millennial, so I spend a lot of time online. I'm on Facebook. I get wrapped into these long discussions and things like that. And then the rest of my life kind of takes over. You know, I have a job, I have a child, I have a family, and it's hard to remember that actually doing things often means showing up in person. So the reason we formed this committee was to try to figure out how to bridge that gap, how to bring what's happening in the meetings to people online. How do we talk about this in a way that everyone can participate.
What is the role of online communities and the way information travels through them in solving a problem IRL, you know, like in real life on the ground? Don't people kind of have the tools they need to share that information and get themselves together without a formal committee to do it?
Yes and no. So the formal committee really exists to find the neighborhood association's place in that, because right now we don't really have an official online avenue of communication. We have emails, we have a Facebook page, but there's no official participation in that discussion. And there's no good resource online for people to look at. Like, we may have all of the answers to their questions at a board meeting 6 months ago, but how does someone who just moved into the neighborhood last week get that info? So right now what we're trying to do is we're working on rebuilding our website and our social media pages to have those resources available all the time. Because the first thing someone's going to do when they want an answer is Google it.
And so you have figured out how to make sure that answer is there and waiting for them?
That's what we're working on.
So it also kind of sounds to me like you're trying to solve the problem of how bad we've become at solving problems.
I wouldn't say we've become bad at it, but I would say that it's done in a different way. And there are a lot of challenges because, as I said, people feel like they're being really productive when they're behind a keyboard. And things do get done that way. I don't want to dismiss social media. It can be very effective, but we're not necessarily doing enough just by typing, just by sending a message, just by liking something. You know, people may think they're making their voice heard because they liked a status on this unofficial page, and that's enough, but that's not a vote. That's not participation in a committee. So, yeah, the challenge is bridging the gap between those two things.
Lydia DeMonte and Roxana Chaffee, thank you so much for joining us from the Hyde Park neighborhood.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Up next, problem solving in Manheim Park. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. Don't go away. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now let's pick back up with our conversation about how communities come together to solve problems in a time when most of us are more connected by technology than by neighborhoods or other kinds of physical spaces. Do we know whose door to knock on when something goes wrong, or do we have to reach out in some other way? Our next guest is Seft Hunter, with us from Communities Creating Opportunity, or CCO. He's been the director there for just 8 weeks. Hi, Seft.
Hey, good morning.
So you started out organizing in Kansas City in the Manheim Park neighborhood, right?
Yes, that's right.
Tell me that story.
Yeah, so my partner William and I, he's an urban planner, got his degree from UMKC. So we moved to Truce back in 2011. You know, Truce has just an important place within Kansas City's history. Having moved to Truce, we got involved by just volunteering in the Manheim neighborhood at one of their Saturday cleanups and decided to move there shortly after that. And so it was just primarily just basically an invitation from someone in Manheim to come check them out. And ultimately, we ended up just moving across the street to Manheim.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about your background, where you grew up, and the different kinds of things you've done? Because you've had an interesting career and a really varied background.
Yeah, so I'm originally from Jamaica. My dad was a migrant worker here in the 70s. He was undocumented back then in the 70s. They were referred to as illegal aliens. The frame of undocumented person simply did not exist. He was undocumented for a number of years. Got amnesty in the 1980s through President Reagan's amnesty program. And then through just that one change in public policy, he was able to move myself and my seven other siblings to the United States in the 80s. I came here, joined the military, served in the military for 6 years. I was in the Air Force, went to graduate school and an undergraduate at West Virginia University in Morgantown, West Virginia, and did my PhD in Tampa at the University of South Florida in Tampa. Came to Kansas City in 2008 as the sponsored programs officer for a local medical school, the osteopathic medical school here in Kansas City. And that's just my quick path of how I how I landed here.
And you've been an EMT, right?
I have. I did that job when I was in the military. That was my job when I was in the Air Force.
So I'm kind of curious about this. Being an EMT is a very hands-on kind of problem solving. You're face-to-face with a human being in an emergency, and you're administering life-saving assistance. That's one kind of problem solving. And then on the other end of the spectrum, in some ways maybe, is being the director of an organization that plans and strategizes and maybe more of an abstract kind of problem solving. Can you talk to me about the difference and similarities in those two kinds of things?
Yeah, well, I think the difference and the similarities are, you know, in both roles, you're working with folks who may be in a position of crisis, right? And the sense of being in the military and working with folks who may be in a medical emergency, oftentimes you are, you know, basically the difference between whether or not somebody lives or dies, right? So the services that you provide in that moment is really about life sustaining. Now, fast forwarding to the role in communities, especially working east of Truce, when we look at the persistence and the depth and challenges, oftentimes it can be critical, right? And in many of the cases, the things that we're looking at as it relates to a culture of disinvestment, as it relates to high level of violence, the similarities are quite the same in the sense that in both roles, folks are in a position of crisis where without intervention, you know, the likelihood of dying prematurely is a real possibility.
So you as an EMT, I mean, my assumption is, you know, like the cardiovascular system and how to get it doing what it has to do when it's not. I mean, you learn some objective systems and interventions. Is there an equivalent in something like, tackling prevalent inequality?
Yeah, well, I think in both roles, it requires a deep understanding of systems, right? So take, for example, the systems of poverty east of Truce, right? Part of looking at that through a systems understanding requires us to take a step back and understand, how did we get here, right? What were the specific policies and practices that led us to this place? So being able to see the interconnectedness between issues is critically important. And that understanding then provides the kind of tools and resources that is needed to then shift the balance of power on behalf of folks who are still remain in that system, predominantly in East of Truce communities.
How did you come to community organizing at all? Your background doesn't seem to like spell that out as where you were headed necessarily.
Well, I think part of what I have to recognize is that there was nothing special about me in the sense that, you know, I wasn't any more worthy than any of the other folks in the small village that I was raised in Jamaica, right? I just happened to have parents who made a set of decisions that allowed me the opportunity to be able to get access to a wonderful educational system that opened a number of doors for me that many folks in my community in Jamaica still, you know, irrespective of their brilliance, irrespective of their hard work, they're going to hit a ceiling, right? And so I was able to get access to that opportunity. And part of, as I've kind of matured and grown, is just recognizing with that comes great responsibility, right? So I can say, yep, I'm at local medical school. I'm making a six-figure salary. I got a really good education. I could roll up the drawbridge. But for me, that does not seem right. That does not seem true with the level of investment that is made in me. And so part of how I think about, the skills that I've developed, they're only relevant to the extent that they can be utilized to mitigate the pain of folks in local communities here in Kansas City and across the region. And that's how I'm really thinking about it, right? So to the extent that I have access to the ability to be able to lift up the challenges in local communities, those skills only matter to the extent that we're able to do good with that.
But how, so you're a medical student making this nice six-figure salary, and you decide it's not enough, I've got to do something. What is the first thing you do? I'm curious, like, as a person who might be out there listening, thinking, yep, there are things I want to do something about.
Yeah.
What do you do?
So I'm a PhD, not necessarily MD, but I've worked with physicians and medical professionals for quite some time. Basically, I got to tell you, it was a real struggle. It was an absolute struggle. You spent a tremendous amount of time preparing for a career in one field. And then the possibility, it wasn't something that I was thinking about. It certainly was not something that I was planning for. But this opportunity came up to work with local communities. This opportunity came up about 3 years ago to step into an organization, four-decade-old organization, CCO, and work with folks who are in the throes of trying to identify how do they even begin to get started to tackle these decade-old systemic challenges of race and lack of access to economic opportunity. And I got to tell you, I absolutely struggled with stepping into this role. But 3 years later, I got to tell you, it's probably the most meaningful thing I've ever done in my life.
It does seem like, yeah, it would be hard to help communities figure out how to begin to tackle decades-old problems. Can you give an example of a problem that just seemed huge, insurmountable, where you were able to at least chip away at something?
Well, I would say the issue of persistent poverty and low wages for workers, specifically here in Kansas City and across the region. So back in 2012, CCO and a number of organizations attempted to move a state ballot initiative to raise wages and then cap the rate on payday loans at 36% or lower. And while we made progress, we captured thousands of signatures. We fell short and the initiative did not ultimately get on the ballot. And so coming back to this, we decided we need to move something at the municipal level. So again, working in a coalition of folks, we basically got Kansas City City Council work to basically do the work to raise wages by passing a local ordinance. Now, that issue is caught up in the courts and it's being litigated. On August 8th, we have an issue on the local ballot to again ask Kansas City to affirm that we want to set as a floor that folks who are working 60 hours a week in Kansas City should not make less than $15 an hour. So, you know, that is an issue that is going on for some time, but we are making progress on it.
So it seems like politics and political systems and policy, you know, that these are some of your preferred tools for problem solving. I think a lot of people, other than going and voting, don't feel like they are connected in any way beyond that to those tools. I'm curious about that culturally. I mean, you've lived and worked in different cities, different regions, and as we've heard, even different countries. And I'm assuming that different communities have different cultures of problem solving.
Yeah, I think that's right. But there is a connected thread, right? And that is, you know, folks who are in a position where they're struggling, their aspirations are no different from each other, right? So if you're a mother living in Tampa, for example, on the east side, urban community, if you're a mom living on the east side of Kansas City, your aspirations for your children are no different, right? So, you know, I think the idea that, you know, we are so very different from each other, in some ways, it's a little bit more complicated than that. And so what we seek are, what are the connections? What are our shared values and aspirations, right? And that becomes the kind of predicate for how we invite folks into a process where we begin to think about how do we chip away, as you referenced earlier, at issues that are so deeply rooted, that are so, you know, immobile, right? Issues that are so challenging, right? And I think the way in which we begin to chip away at those issues is to identify what are our shared values and then what are our shared aspirations for whatever that issue is, whether it be wages, whether it be healthcare access, whether it be reducing violence in a community. We really look at shared values and shared aspirations, and that becomes the strongest motivation for how we invite and then sustain engagement with the local communities with whom we work.
But engagement's just one piece of it, right? I mean, how do people, what are some of the steps people take that when they want to become engaged,
sure,
to go from, I don't have a role in this, to I've found something that I can do, an action I can take?
Yeah, and I think the most powerful thing is for each of us to identify what is our why. Right. So in the issue of, let's say, violence in a community, well, why does that matter to you in a real way? Right. So oftentimes what we will do, our model requires that we bring folks together and have you step out in a public space with your neighbors and say, why is this important to you specifically, not generally? Why does this matter to you directly? Right. And in hearing those issues, then what commitments can we make together to begin tackling this issue in a systematic way?
Seft Hunter, former president of the Manhattan Neighborhood Association and executive director of Communities Creating Opportunity, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We also spoke today with Damon Daniel of the Ad Hoc Group Against Crime and Roxana Chaffee and Lydia DeMonte from the Hyde Park neighborhood. Tomorrow, you can join us to hear a local photographer talking about photographing and interviewing people in Kansas City's homeless population. Plus, we'll play the story that won KCUR's Alex Smith a National Edward R. Murrow Award for its use of sound. You can listen back to anything you've heard on KCUR Central Standard at kcur.org/centralstandard and talk to us on Twitter. We're at KCURCST. This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan. Danielle Hogarty is our intern. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.